You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Andrew Hammond, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations from authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes and whatever platform you might be listening from. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. Well, I want to unpack your career and some of the things that you've done, but one of the ways that we were put in touch was through our mutual friend, Janosch Newman. And I know that you were involved in a documentary. Could you just tell our listeners a little bit more about that documentary?
This fell into my lap. In 2017, I was contacted by this really phenomenal journalist, Justin Warlick. Justin was working with this production company called Hot Snakes Media, and they were teaming up with A&E to produce a show that was going to be about undercover operations. And they were going to pick three or four or five former agents, officers who had worked in government and had, you know, some kind of background in undercover operations. Now, Justin had gone on to an FBI retired site, discovered me that one of my specialties from the past was being an undercover program coordinator. I was that for a number of years in the Houston division, which means I oversaw technical aspects and certain administrative aspects of all the undercover operations across all investigative areas, whether it was criminal, national security, and so forth. And prior to that, I had early part of my career, I had worked drug cartels for a number of years, and we were extensively involved in undercover operations. And I was a case agent on several. I was contact agent for undercovers. I had just a little bit of undercover, roles myself. But anyway, so Justin picked me out. There were a number of interviews with the network and the production team. And during the process, they said, well, tell us about your career and what you enjoyed. And I said, probably one of the biggest things I enjoyed was working Russian organized crime. And I said, I just found them to be so challenging, and they were like chess masters and always thinking ahead, but at the same time, they could be brutal, just very complex, interesting work. And I said, as a matter of fact, I had a colleague recently who had some connection with the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. And he told me that there was Russian organized crime presence in the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. I go, what? You got to be kidding. I had no idea. I've never heard that. So they go, wow, that sounds fascinating. So they say, okay, let's pursue that. And they made a decision to drop the other show and to run with this. So they had us go do a sizzle reel in the Smoky Mountains, and we did our research. Then it's, you know, so we're asking ourselves, why are there even a number of Russians in that part, Gatlinburg, Tennessee, Pigeon Forge, Tennessee? Okay, so we started looking in more into it. It's like, why is there such a sizable population in the mountains? And we come across these stories. And again, Justin is a phenomenal researcher, just a really phenomenal journalist. And we discovered that in 1994, an Oak Ridge National Lab nuclear scientist had traveled to Russia and as part of checking out the security and safety after Chernobyl, and had become disillusioned with his line of work and decided he wanted to start an exchange program to bring kids over to work in Dollywood in the area. And there was that was welcome because there was a need for the kids to come over and work. So an exchange program started. Anyway, that's getting back to the main part of the story, is that this Oak Ridge National Laboratory, which, by the way, is probably the most sensitive, prominent scientific and technical facility perhaps in the world, when it comes to, particularly with nuclear material. And there are other cutting edge, you know, research that goes on in the area, and very, very valuable, you know, national security area. So we go back and look at Howard Kurz, was the scientist, what he'd done on TV before, and his talking about the story. And then we went and interviewed him, and he told us, yeah, that he was warned that to stay away from, be careful with the translators, you know, and he just kind of laughed about it. And he also said that on a trip there that he had this overwhelming thirst. And so the other, his Duma, his colleague, pulled over to the side of the road to kiosk for water, and they're standing in line, and he's talking about, you know, I hope we really get some good kids. I don't want, you know, to bring bad kids there. And this beautiful blonde female behind him says, oh, by the way, I couldn't help but overhear what you were talking about. I'm a teacher. I know good students. I can bring them there. And like I said, in undercover operations, I dealt with national security matters. So in my understanding, a U.S. government official traveling to Russia, nothing happens by coincidence to that person when they're there. Yeah. And so, long story short, it became obvious to us that this was a setup. The translator he ends up marrying was a setup. And the teacher who spoke, beautiful blonde teacher who spoke perfect English, was a setup. And another thing that in the process that really got my attention was that we interviewed Howard three times. Each interview, he said exactly the same thing about the details. I mean, word for word, almost. As an investigator, that gets your attention. It's like, why is he repeating the same words, the same statements, the exact... It was remarkable to me.
Because people don't normally do that.
No, not normally. They alter it some. It's, you know, the substance may be the same, but it was just remarkable how it was almost verbatim. So we put together, you know, we started this investigation, and the network says, okay, go find a spy. In that year and a half, I interviewed more interesting people than most, you know, agents do in a whole career. You know, everybody from Oleg Kalugin, Jack Barsky, and the Mike McFall, former ambassador to Russia, and the granddaughter, great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev at the New University. One of her students turned out to be the Russian posing as Murphy, the Murphy couple that were part of the Operation Ghost Stories. The FBI arrested 11 back in 2010, and including Anna Chapman, Juan Lozano, whose real name was, if I get this right, Mikhail Antonovich, and he was posing as South American. Now, I interviewed a neighbor of the Murphys, and again, it was interesting to get, the story, like, they just appeared like normal, Americans. In the show, the Americans, developed as a result of them, pretty much. And what was one fascinating thing that I left with was we talked with the attorney of Juan Lozano, Juan Lozano, and she said she had no idea he was Russian. He spoke Russian or anything remotely similar to that until two Russian diplomats showed up in jail and they all started speaking Russian. So that's just how good their tradecraft was. We found a network and we found people that were responsible for reporting, and whether they were duped or voluntary participants, witting or unwitting, it was definitely the groundwork for a spy network, for a very valuable area of scientific knowledge and cutting edge research.
So just a few questions to clarify, Dennis. So where is Oak Ridge National Laboratory? For people that don't know Tennessee, is it southeast, northwest, the Mississippi border? Where is it?
Yeah, it's adjacent to Knoxville, which is central to northern eastern part of Tennessee. It's kind of secluded area. It was an army base prior to it being designated. Actually, the initiation of the Manhattan Project occurred there. It moved to Los Alamos for the testing and everything, but basically the research was done there, and they created this laboratory around that. And it's a fascinating area. It really is. Probably 50 miles away is Pigeon Forge with Dollywood and all the amusements. I mean, this area brings in, I think I was told, like 10 million or more visitors a year. And then there's Gatlinburg, which is a big tourist area. So that's where Oak Ridge is.
And so is this Oak Ridge National Laboratory, is this part of the government or is that a private organization? Or
it's part of it's within the auspices, I believe, of the Department of Energy.
Okay.
So it is a government facility.
So the Russians around there, were they organized crime or were they Russian intelligence operatives, or was there, or are the two of them never completely distinct?
All of the above, I would say.
One of the things that I think would be quite interesting would be to go back to the beginning of the story and then maybe explore some of the different things you've done in your really rich career. So how did you end up in the FBI? Because I know that you went to law school, right?
Yes. I was one of those probably rare kids who knew exactly what I wanted to do when I grew up. I grew up watching, shows and about the FBI, and that just, it stuck with me. And I said, I think that's what I want to do. So I pursued that route and that interest. And then when it came to college, I was like, well, the avenues of getting in are, as a lawyer, accountant who's CPA qualified, or diverse background, science, so forth, with a certain number of years of experience, work experience. So I went the law school route. And actually, because the hiring was limited at the time, I actually worked for about 3 years, two and a half, three years, two and a half years. And I was a prosecutor for 2.5 years. there. And then my ticket got punched, and I'm like, yep, this is it. I'm going to live the life of adventure and, you know, see the world, so to speak. And it was a remarkable experience.
Tell us what it was like when you joined and what it was like when you left.
Well, when I joined, it was, first of all, you don't know where you're going to, you know, be assigned. And, you know, they said Houston, Texas, and I'm going, what, Houston? I mean, is that a cow town or something? And a guy in my class, oh, no, you're it's the fourth largest city in the country. You're going to have a great time. And I did. It became one of the hubs of drug trafficking, drug cartels. It's kind of shifted from, you know, South Florida, the Caribbean, to bringing the drugs up through Mexico and then involving, you know, the Mexican drug cartels. So we work both Colombians and Mexican, you know, cartels. And it, at the time, like I said, there was, I remember the office where all the criminal squads, including, you know, the ones we had, and there were a number of drug squads, organized crime we did at the same time. And there were white collar crime squads and theft squads and interstate theft squads and things of that nature. And then there was almost like a physical divide, like the elevators, the foreign counterintelligence squads were in the other side. And we intermingled, but it was a whole different area. After 9/11, and when the focus shifted to, you know, predominantly working counterterrorism, and they started letting down some of the barriers, the walls to information sharing. And I'll tell you a funny story. My first is a brand new agent, no matter what your background is, you have to learn the trust. And so they never let me go out on a surveillance, you know, with them until one day we had a wiretap on, it was part of the Pizza Connection case out of the Northeast, but we had Sicilians who were running a pizza parlor in Galveston, Texas. And I can discuss this because it was prosecuted and everything. And we knew that and this was very, I remember the two brothers, and it was like right out of the movies. I mean, they were very animated, very comical. We had a wiretap. We found out that they were going to travel to New York. So we wanted to put them on the plane and contact the agents so they could take them off, you know, and follow them once they got to New York. So they said, okay, we need you today. And it was a Saturday, and it was February, I think. So I had to find a car. And it's not like, I think cars are more plentiful now. And eventually we, you know, you got assigned cars, but, so there was a white collar squad next to us. So that Friday I'm like, has anybody got a car? I need a car. He said, oh yeah, yeah. There's one that, you know, it kind of, yeah, you know, it sits around a lot. Doesn't always work right, but yeah, you could take that. So I took that, and it was like a Plymouth or something, you know? So we're on surveillance, and it's raining and it's cold, and the car turns off and I can't get it started. So one of the other agents, senior agents, comes by, and he says, in that time they call out, say they're moving, the subjects are moving. So they had to go. He says, sorry, but I'm like, okay, go, you know? So I had to walk to a service station in the, you know, rain and, like, you know, 30 degree weather, and get a record. It comes, he jumps me, and I'm like, okay, I can make it, because they detoured, they stopped at some house. I'm like, I can make it. I can see him get on the plane. That's my objective. So I'm rushing up to the airport, you know, in Houston, and I get pulled over by a patrol car right at the airport for an expired registration on the government car.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
I know that you've also worked Colombian organized crime, Mexican cartels, the Russian mafia, Sicilians. Do you have to approach each of them in a different way, or is it pretty much the same set of tools just applied to a different group of people?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. There, investigation is an investigation, but you do need to understand the cultures and the differences. The Colombian cartels, we worked mostly the Cali cartel, and they were more businesslike. They were I've never seen such business ingenuity, and still looking at them and studying them, they would find out ways to cooperate, you know. And if you've seen Narcos, the series Narcos, it does a good job of setting this out, but they would learn to utilize each other's expertise, and it was a business model. You know, they may be competitors, but at some point it's like, okay, you can, the ships aren't working anymore. The planes are getting interdicted. So how can we get the shipments in to the US? Well, you use the Mexican cartels who've been running contraband for decades across the border. You work out a sharing arrangement. The Mexican cartels, we work primarily the Gulf cartel, and we did a pretty good job of dismantling it, putting Juan Garcia Abrego, multi-agency, multi-case matters. And I had become sort of one of the lead agents for putting a number of different cases together, in which there had been seizures of over 10,000 kilos of cocaine, multi-millions of dollars. And so I had testified in a trial, they moved it from Brownsville to Corpus Christi. Brownsville's right at the tip of Texas border with Mexico, and Corpus Christi's 2 or 3 hours north of that, because there had been two hits. And I remember testifying about the organization. I had this picture of them, and I would say, okay, this guy's in Mexican prison, this guy's in US prison, this guy was killed by them, this guy was killed by rival organization, and go through the photos, and this one has moved up and so forth. So I'm driving back to Houston that evening, and I get a call from the office. They said, hey, just want to give you a heads up, you know, watch your back even more, because two witnesses just got killed. One had been a cooperator. The other would not even testify. He was called to testify for the government. He wouldn't say anything, and he still got killed. Another thing that we did, and I became kind of adept at, was getting defendants to cooperate, cartel members, you know, getting them to cooperate. And even if they were primarily Spanish speakers, you develop a bond with them, a rapport, and you try to treat them with respect. Dealing with the Russian organized crime, and we had some Ukrainians involved, and they were also cooperators. It was a very much a learning experience because that was very different from a lot of the other organizations I had worked. As I've said before, they're in many ways like chess players, and they think, you know, 4, 5, 6 moves ahead, where US, we're you know, maybe two ahead or three at the time. It's just a whole different, but at the same time, they could be very brutal.
You know, to the uninitiated, this all sounds incredibly dangerous, going up against the Gulf cartel, the Cali cartel, Russian organized crime. How much do you feel exposed, and how much is there a kind of halo around you as an FBI agent?
So working particularly the Colombian cartels, we didn't feel that threatened because they were more business oriented. Now we had very ingrained undercovers who I think were always at risk. And but for the most part, and we would hear on wiretaps, like one time one of our colleagues on our squad, we found out that they were talking about killing him. And I think at some point they realized, well, wait a minute, he's an FBI agent. No, it's going to be bad for business. So they didn't, or something else transpired. But when it comes to more like the gang levels, the street levels, the younger, it is more dangerous because they don't think like that. They don't think the business way necessarily. And they don't have that same reasoning that a more mature person might have. And, you know, just an example, what, last week or 2 weeks ago, two agents, FBI agents were killed on an arrest for, you know, pornography, child pornography. I think that the image of the FBI agent does carry a bit of cachet that that is helpful. You know, I think it's very dangerous out there now. When I ran our special operations group, and we were involved in a takedown of some MS-13 members, and the SWAT team was set up in a house, and there was a shootout. I just think it's riskier now than it was, you know, back in the early 90s. And there was a lot of danger, but I just think there's so many variables and so many unknowns, and the climate out there is such that there's concern about anti-government sentiment and everything. So
when do you join up and when do you leave, Dennis?
Yeah, I entered the FBI in 1986, and I left in 2008.
And you start your career in Houston and you end in Houston, is that right?
I did.
And give us a sense of the journey between those stints in Houston. What are some of the other things that you've done?
You know, the drug cartels, and I did that until, at the same time, I was on SWAT team and enhanced SWAT team and a firearms instructor. Excuse me, I was sort of an ancillary legal advisor at times. And then I did the international police instruction. I was promoted to supervisory position in 1995 and supervised drug task force, and then came back in the office organized crime squad. Then I was assigned to an intelligence, and then I was transferred to our special operations. They had that up, and we were offsite, covert identities, covert offsites. And at the time, we worked primarily counterterrorism because that was the hot, you know, area. We watched a lot of individuals who we had information indicating that, hey, they had received training in other countries. They'd been to, you know, terrorist training. But it was interesting. We would watch them and watch them and watch them, and nothing necessarily would happen.
You mentioned the SWAT team. What's the biggest misperception that people have about a SWAT team? Because most of us just know it from watching, you know, TV shows and so forth. What's it actually like to be on a SWAT team?
You know, it's part of the appeal is the teamwork, the brotherhood, and the training and the constant training and the train that has an appeal to certain people, and it did. Again, I think it goes back to what I call the old days. I think they tended to have more fun too. We went on some missions and we would find a way to have a good time at the same time. And, you know, there was one mission where we spent a week waiting for the rain to stop so we could go in on a meth lab. We were dropped in at, you know, certain locations. We had to walk through some fields at night, crawl through some woods, and then, you know, by daylight hit the locations. And there were just some really characters that were on the team that would, you know, we would cut up and be serious at the same time. I spent 5 weeks at Waco at the siege there. That was just a mixed, you know, I'll put it this way. When, it's well known there were conflicts between the negotiators and the tactical personnel, you know, to some extent. And I was picked at some point to go. Koresh had decided to release a few of the kids. And another agent and I were designated to drive our vehicle to pick up two of the kids. It was like a meeting point with Koresh's people. And we took the kids in. And I remember driving, taking them to the command post, which was at an airport. And I remember looking in the rearview mirror and this little girl and looking at her eyes and just thinking, she's so innocent. And I just had this overwhelming feeling like this is not going to go well for either side. And unfortunately, it didn't. The FBI has so many interesting, talented, you know, people, no matter what the background, very diverse backgrounds. You could be a school teacher, could be a you know, a scientist. I know one who was a veterinarian and he, you know, became an agent and just, you know, could be hardcore military type, and then the artist. You know, one of the agents I was kind of, he was older, you know, and he had been in the Vietnam War just as back when I was a brand new agent. And he had this gruff exterior, very matter of fact. And, you know, one day he invited me, said, hey, come with my family, have dinner and, you know, meet the family. And I did. And I found out that he's an artist. He painted pictures. I'm like, where did that come from? You know? So it's just a very, but what I believe is there's this, through the testing, the, you know, psychological testing, the actual test you take, and there's this thread that runs throughout that they look for. And that is, basically, they're looking for people who want to do the right thing and people who, you know, are team oriented. And I've found that in the private sector, you know, with my company, I've got 10 or 12 former, you know, retired agents working under my company umbrella, and as well as other agency personnel. And they're just phenomenal people. But now, you need to make a profit, you know, so it's more profit driven. But what I realized is that when it comes down to it, we're still wired as public servants, even though we're in the private sector and we want to make a profit. We're still just wired that way. We want to help people. We want to make sure they're safe. it's just, you know, it's just something about our personalities, I think.
Just tell us a little bit more about your company and about the types of things that you do.
Yeah, my company, it's Investigative and Security Global Solutions. We are involved in almost any kind of investigation from A to Z. We do a lot of litigation support for law firms, for private clients, for families, corporations, even corporations that have their own security departments. We supplement them with investigations sometimes and security. We do security assessments, vulnerability assessments of sometimes businesses, sometimes corporate offices in you know, estates, where we will go in and advise them of what, you know, we think the risks are and what they need to do. We provide some security and executive protection. And the thing is, sometimes we get involved in some cases that some investigations that bring us back to the old days. They're complex. For example, without going into any details, we were recently in another part of Texas, and I had two guys were former snipers in ghillie suits on the ground overnight watching something while resting. Others were in strategic positions watching things. So it was like a, you know, a surveillance sting kind of operation. And it's good to every once in a while to do that, because, you know, see that you still, you know, have it, and, you know, and it's kind of, it brings back the adrenaline from, you know, the old days. We do a lot of surveillance with, no matter what kind of case it is, you know, theft of trade secrets, non-competes, you know, fraud, just, you know, comes down to it. There's a lot of fraud. You know, you can categorize whatever it is. It's just fraud or theft.
And the final question I have is, I know that you live and work in Texas now, but you were born and raised in North Carolina. So who's got the best barbecue?
Oh, yeah. The North Carolina pork barbecue with the red pepper vinegar sauce is, I grew up with that. And that's Texas barbecue it's great too. You know, the brisket, you know, it's the beef brisket with the red, you know, barbecue sauce. And, you know, I live in Austin now, which it's not only music, you know, one of the live music capitals, but there's a lot of good food, a lot of barbecue here. Houston has phenomenal food too, just all kinds. I tend to favor the North Carolina barbecue, but I don't get, you know, a chance to eat it much anymore.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and would like to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.